started. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is the Lanes. It's nice to have you all here. This is my wife Cynthia's restaurant. We've turned it into a literary salon where I've interviewed over 100 authors since we've opened. Can everybody hear me okay in the back over there? You guys are good? Okay. Welcome, everybody's really good. And thank you all for eating and drinking. You're keeping us in business. I really appreciate it. I'm excited for today's interview. Christopher Chambers is a Washington, D.C. native, a lecturer at Georgetown University, chair of the International Conflict Resolution Center, and is general counsel to the not-for-profit benefiting HBCUs, Student Housing of America. He's an author of the Angela Bivens thriller series for Random House, the Rocket Crockett Pulp Noir series, and the Black Pulp for Prose Press, and editor, along with Gary Phillips, of the Darker Mask graphic short story collection. I'm really excited to hear more about that, by the way. The Bronze Buckaroo rides again, honoring Harlem's Herb Jeffries, and he was a finalist in the 2008 for the Penn Malamud Short Story Award for Leviathan. He's contributed short stories to The Obama Inheritance, 15 Stories of Conspiracy Noir from Three Rooms Press, and winner of the Anthony Award. The Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, The Faking of the President in Midnight Hour, Witnesses for the Dead with Gar Anthony Haywood, all major award-winning collections and bestsellers. His noir hard-boiled mystery Scavenger in 2020 won the Starred Review and Profile in Publishers Weekly. That's very hard to do, by the way. The sequel standalone sees the return to the indestructible homeless addict turned PI, Dickie Cornish, patrolling the unforgiving city streets ravaged by COVID with the third in the trilogy, Streetwise, which is what we're here to talk about today. And that just launched, was that on Tuesday? When did it launch? Was it last Tuesday or?
Oh, yeah, early April.
Early April.
Early April.
So we're close.
We're close, yes.
His next Marvel contribution is Captain America, the Shield of Sam Wilson. So please welcome Christopher Chambers.
Thank you.
So, Chris, this is, I just absolutely love your writing. I'm a big fan. Let's
Thank
start
you.
there. Why don't you tell us, Streetwise, this is the third of the series, right? In the Cornish series.
Right.
Why don't you give us just a little bit of thumbnail sketch of what it's about?
Well, it's basically the third in the arc, which I planned out as a trilogy because I started out he was a homeless, booze drinking, addicted person, and now you see him go through, through treatment at the VA. Now he's a full-fledged PA. So, it's really, why don't I put it in this context? Was I when I had my lunch with George Pelicanos, I was telling him this: is it when I started out to emulate him, the DC book was what my mother used to take to the beach, which was a Robert Ludlum book that was this thick about somebody trying to kidnap the president. And George was the one who really blew that open and said, "This city is just like Chandler and Hammett and all these other places, just like New Orleans, New York, Brooklyn. It's like Chester Himes, Harlem. It has a whole life to it." And so I wanted to really bring that to life, and do something different on the DC novel and really emulate him. So this character is basically gone from unhoused and on literally picking people's garbage off off the street as they help. In the DC for a while, if you were a landlord and you were kicking out a tenant, they would hire homeless guys to take people's stuff and put them out on the curb. That's how he made his money, to a full-fledged PI now. And in this one, you see the culmination of his growth and evolution and change from what he was to what he is now. Now he still has problems, but you see him in the first novel. The first novel is written in second person, which is no mean feat, because of the voices in his head. Now it is traditional first person, private eye. I did this. I walked through this room. I felt a bullet whiz by my head, kind of a narration. And I wanted to show that kind of progression of this human being where he started off as a productive young person in college, and there's this ellipsis. I mean, and then homelessness is an ellipsis. It's an interruption. A lot of these people were somebody before something happened, abuse, addiction, whatever, and now he's back to where he thinks maybe he should have been. And I wanted to show in this third book, this is where he should have been, even though this might not have been his chosen, vocation. He wanted to be an athlete. He was a scholar athlete in college, and then, drugs interrupted that. But that's where I wanted to be, and I wanted to show this. I wanted to show this progression, and I think I pulled it off, hopefully.
So you're calling it a trilogy. So is this it for this character, or will you continue the series or do some kind of spin-off from it?
I don't know, Jeff. I don't know. I tease a lot of people about that. I there's I never say never, as Sean Connery once said. But I always planned it as a trilogy, and we'll see where it goes. I mean, everybody seems to love what it's become. I would love to see it, get some new life, and we're exploring, options. I can't say too much else. My confidant here, she's closed-lipped too. We have our marital NDA here, so. But we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I think the characters and the stories are at a place now. The problem is, I'm feeling a lot of pressure, needless to say. The Strand magazine came out an assessment of me and said I'm the I said I think they said I was the inheritor of Cain and Chandler and Woolrich, and I'm like,
No
good
pressure
God,
there.
no pressure there. So I'm like, it's kind of white knuckle time. So we'll see.
I mean, it seems like trilogies are generally easier to sell, but it takes a long time to get people to buy into a character, and a lot of publishers talk about like that fourth book when it starts really paying off, right? So you spend all this time doing like reader acquisition. It seems like almost a waste to walk away from a character that's so loved at this point.
Yeah, and I think really it was built in though. When you look at the character's arc from Scavenger, where he is like literally the first few lines of the book, he is like escaped from Washington Hospital Center in a gown, with a shunt still in his arm, and he's hallucinating, to now he's a full-fledged kind of rough and tumble PI. I mean, that. I think people want to see more of him. So that, but I did try to plan that out.
You talk about looking at DC and Pelicano's doing the same thing, right? As equal to New York or LA for noir fiction. To what extent is DC a character in this book? Because I mean, on every page, right, the city it imposes itself onto the narrative.
Well, in noir is kind of stylized reality, and the verisimilitude is a character, with new wave cozies, with domestic suspense, with old school cozies. The verisimilitude is not really a character. With noir, hard boiled, it has to be a character. With police procedurals, it has to be a character. That's the probably the good thing about our subgenre, and the burden. And you see that in spy novels, to some extent as well. I mean, the verisimilitude has to be a character, so I have to be true to that. And the descriptions and the atmosphere, that is part of the deal. And if you don't nail that, then you're ingenuous. You're screwed on a number of levels, because you're disingenuous to your readers, the ones who live here, and then the ones who might live in Alaska, who are looking for that atmosphere. And it just then it starts to play off tropes and stereotypes, and you just kind of lost something. So I try to be as realistic as possible in the setting, not just the characters, but the setting. And let me just give you a quick pop. I mean, I'll give you a couple of lines. Let me, and I'll get, it's really an interesting comparison and contrast. And let me just give you this paragraph, and I want you all to guess where this is, and then I want you to guess when I give you the next reading where this is. Okay, so wouldn't have savvied this dude Schultz for this spot. I mean, first, he's supposed to be penniless. These are federal-style tidy brick row houses that rival the stooped brownstone stuff up in New York. Some with cupolas and cornices, some squat and colorful, camouflaged by the last greenery or yellow hydrangeas of the season. And all around, the oaks, maples, and elms providing shade. In other words, perfect for white folks with older sensibilities. Doesn't go with the younger white boys in our chocolate city, though. They opt for the flashier roof deck condos in on 14th and U, or Union Market, or up with the Birkenstock types in Columbia Heights, or the beer gardens around the baseball stadium at the Navy Yard. I mean, he's talking about Capitol Hill, by the way. And so then you try to draw a contrast because the setting has to be a character. So contrast with this. The driver, a Somali from his face and name on the app, wasn't pleased about the destination, complaining about the whole trip. If he had a ramjet powering the car back to Ferry Kennedy Center's back to curtain time, you would have seen his vapor trail, and I don't blame him, as two girls barely out of middle school, like the youngs I scattered the other night, snuffed a driver near the Navy Yard a couple of months prior. Me? I'm in my mix, though, and I'm surveying these brothers who turn plastic soda pallets fronting a corner store into ersatz lounge chairs. Street lamps are buzzing on, and up on the boulevard, thick-thighed women with hair extensions and puffy bedroom slippers tow their whining tots and tongue-lash their lagging tweens. Old men in baggy trousers and ragged baseball caps shuffle and mumble to themselves. Dreadlocked fellows hawk customers outside identical weed shops, like so many hood carny barkers. Same city, different neighborhood.
How much are you from DC?
Yes.
And so how much research do you still have to do, even being from here, when you're writing this?
In our neighborhood, not that much. I just have to go up to Georgia Avenue and talk to people. It's not that it's some of it is just talking to people. Just with the first book, I mean, there were plenty of people who were there who were more than happy to talk. I mean, some of them were winos, some of them were drug addicts, some of them were just people who'd just been there forever. You want to try to keep it fresh. I mean, some of it because I mean, Jeff, for men of a certain age. I mean,
Thanks, I appreciate
Yeah, I know you love that. I
that.
mean, most of the research really has to be. That's the issue is that I'm not 20 years old. Some of the slang and some of the atmospheric stuff doesn't change. Some of it does. But then again, culture is culture. I mean, I'll give you an example of a story that I got yesterday. A friend of mine was going to use the books to try to get young people. He's teaching up in Baltimore, and to summer read. I mean, this is heavy stuff. I mean, this is R-rated stuff. Okay, but he wanted to get his teenagers up. He teaches at City College, which is it's not a college, but it's the high school, citywide high school in Baltimore, two of the citywide all male schools up there, City and Poly. And a group of the kids there, the boys, they didn't want to read it. And they didn't want to, and it's not that they didn't want to read it because they didn't think my voice was authentic, even though I'm, quote, old. It's because they're in Baltimore and this is DC. And you would not believe the difference in culture that 30 miles makes. I mean, it talking about Pelicanos, he was talking about a scene in The Wire where Stringer Bell, who's played by Idris Elba, hires some hitmen from PG County to go up and go after some guys on the east side of Baltimore. And these guys are playing go-go music in their car. And Stringer Bell is going, what in the heck is this? This is crap. And these guys almost say, well, we're not going to take this contract now. You're making fun of our, you know, cultural heritage music, you know, and these kids up in Baltimore, it wasn't the fact that I was old that they didn't like about the book. It's just that it was about DC, you know? And so it's the harder thing is the age thing and the, not, I'm sorry, not the age thing, but the trying to get that deal with that, the fact that we have a very patchwork culture in a tiny region. So, and I didn't really understand that, even though I lived up there and I went to high school up there, I didn't realize that. So it feeds the richness of this area, but it's when you're trying to tell stories, especially in crime fiction, it's something you have to think about.
So, I mean, you make a really good point. The vernacular is space dependent, it's time dependent. And so to like what extent is this a snapshot in time, right? And this is how people are talking now. This is what's happening in this exact area, these neighborhoods. And then how do you have to be careful about that because it maybe doesn't draw as wide an audience?
Well, I mean, I think with the beauty of hard-boiled noir is that I think if people are going to buy it and read it, they know they're going to be transported to a different time. I mean, and that goes back years. If you're talking about Chester Hines or Chandler or Hammett, I mean, they're going to say, you know, at that point, this is not what, you know, this is not what's playing in Peoria, basically. So you're going to be transported to a different time and a different kind of way of thinking, because I think that's what drew people to that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, when you reading the books and then seeing Humphrey Bogart on the screen, on these little basically these little Depression era movie theaters all over the place. They had nothing in common with San Francisco or New York, and they had no clue what the damn Maltese Falcon was. You know, I mean, who cares? It was about the dialogue and the roughness and the toughness and the stories and the characters, and it transports you, but it still keeps that verisimilitude. And I think that yes, it's a hard read in terms of the slang, but people know that going into it, and they want to try to work through that. They know ahead of time that that the slang and the setting is going to be a character. And I think and then the people who don't know that ahead of time, everybody that I know of, you know, fans or just general readers, when I've been anywhere from a Mystery Writers of America event to BoucherCon, they when they finally read it, they say, okay, well, I'm going to work through it, because it's almost like science fiction or horror. You know what you're getting, so you're going to have to work for it. You know, and I think that's part of the journey.
What is it that draws you to like hard boiled noir? Is it something you've just read a lot, or you spend a lot of time writing this stuff, and also because it is kind of dark and it's violent, does it affect your mood outside of the writing?
Well, it's a bunch of things. Some of it's release, some of it's catharsis. You know, I mean, I can't go around talking like James Cagney and push grapefruits in her face like in the movies, you know, so I got to get it out on paper, right? Otherwise she'd hit me with a baseball bat. So it's catharsis. That hard-boiled is that. Some of it, though, to be honest, there was several years ago, I think our genre was being pressed by, and this is true of cozies, and I think when I think I might have mentioned this. I know Mark was on the panel at Malice Domestic, which was the traditional Mark Bergen here was the traditional convention for traditional mysteries, cozies, things like that. And we had a panel on can the subgenres work together, or are they bleeding into one another? And one of the things that people noticed was that the domestic suspense subgenre, girl on the train, girl in the window, gone girl tells girl on the train to shut up. That subgenre, the weight of that, and I'm not complaining about that because that is, there's some amazing work being done there, and it's a huge diverse group of writers writing there, and it's mostly women. The weight of that was really starting to press years ago. It was well before COVID. And I think the art of hard-boiled noir, traditional noir, was starting to kind of, fritter away, to the point where, when Gene Hackman died, people were like, oh, who cares about the French Connection? I mean, it's like it was a lost art almost. But several years ago, Todd Robinson, who's a bartender at this place in the village called the Shade Bar, and he looks like the bouncer because his arms are as big as Popeyes, but he's actually the bartender. He actually had a he's a writer, a hard-boiled writer, but he had a website called Thug Lit, and the logo was a pair of brass knuckles. And the tagline was writing about wrong. And it was his aim to really bring back that kind of traditional Hammett, Chester Himes, Chandler stuff. And he launched a lot of people. I mean, he basically resurrected my interest in it because when I published my first hardcovers with Random House, they were more kind of traditional political thrillers. But I really all and but because Gary people like Gary Phillips and Gar Anthony Haywood and Pelicanos were idols and friends, I really wanted to go towards that detective hard boiled. But it looks like everybody was being pressed and squeezed, and then he created this outlet. So he discovered people like Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby, and if you don't know who Sean Cosby is, you need to find out. I mean, he is the next big. He is not the next big. He is the big thing, the big thing.
Sean's red here. He's got an incredible voice
Yes, he
too.
is right here in our. He is on our NWA chapter. He's a Virginia man, and people like Jordan Harper, Curtis Ippolito, Scott Bundowiak. And then published a lot of short stories that Gary Phillips republished. I redid, and it really re-energized us. But it re-energized us to craft and telling a good story, and hard-boiled as literature, not hard-boiled as Mickey Spillane, walking in, the Mickey Spillane books where you walk in and I walk in and I slap that dame around. I mean, that's gone forever. That was not what he was going for. It was to create a new voice in that, and that kind of buoyed us up. And so, whenever we go to New York, we kind of go to the Shade Bar and bow down to Todd. But he demands that we bow down to him anyway because he's like tall and got muscles, so you got to bow down to him. The only person I think who doesn't is Sean, because you see, Sean is built, so. So that's where that's where that came from. And I think that, I wanted to really kind of be true to that and be the next generation of that, because I think it's important to keep that up. I mean, you see the noir tradition, and people love that. I mean, when you look at on TV, on they have the resurrection of Sam Spade with Monsieur Spade, which is him as a retired private detective in France now, and Clive Owen plays him. You see the redo or the retcon, but it's really not a retcon, which is a term of art in TV. You see Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley. You see that taken back away from the kind of stylized, wonderful, pretty boy Jude Law stuff my wife likes with Jude Law and Matthew Damon, back to its roots with Ripley on Netflix, which was very dark and very noir and no pretty Jude Law, and no pretty Gwyneth Paltrow. I mean, it was very dark, Patricia Highsmith's original work, and that, we're trying to, I like to come back to that because it is a very it's really straightforward, and it is in your face. It does make you work for it, but I think that that's the beauty of it.
Well, I mean, you accomplish that, right? So you talk about like cozies bleeding into the genre. There's a lot of bleeding in your book, but it has nothing to do with cozies, I promise you. And it is, I would consider this like elevated noir, right? It is more literary in nature in a lot of ways. So it's really beautifully written. Can I get you to read just like the first couple paragraphs of the book? Just because your voice is so unique, right? And I want people, but if you don't hear it, you have to hear it to talk about voice. So just read a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, this is just this the beginning, and this really picks up where the second book leaves off in the courthouse, right down at Third and Constitution. Funny, in that instant, I knew I'd moved up in the world. I'm catching a beating from United States Marshals. In the E. Barrett Prettyman Federal Courthouse, during lunch hour, a couple of blocks from the U.S. Capitol. See, that mean also means some honcho who doesn't answer to nobody has greenlit my misery. I came to do my civic duty. Now my civic duty's doing me. Accordingly, stay down, Pops, equal protection growls. Just context. He's making fun of these marshals. He's calling them equal protection and due process. Stay down, Pops, equal protection growls. Lurch looking mother, due process huffs. He's an old fart like me, so kicking at my kidneys while I'm doubled over from equal protection's fist has got him a little winded. Back in the day, I'd be so zooted on the cush or boat that I'd rupture myself jumping the turnstile at Metro Center, dead to midnight. And the WMATA cops would wail on my big ass and toss me out on 13th Street, just in time for an NPD unit to come rolling up. I'd be all mumbles and stumbles, tore up trousers wet with piss, torn toenails all ursine and poking through sneaker canvas, throwing down a beat feet to whatever rare essence bounce was playing in my head. And then I'd do a gladiator yell to the Jakes. Are you not entertained? Nah, they weren't. And after they'd get their licks in, they'd leave me bloody on a bus shelter bench in Silver Spring or across the Potomac in a parking lot with the admonishment not to return to the district. But I'd always come home. I'm a native. Hail to the Redskins with Mambo sauce, Mo. And nothing short of that hot shot of horse in China White, what the regular folk in docks call fentanyl, would keep me from my appointed rounds as a bum. Sorry. Unhoused. Now, back to the beating at hand. And Stamp, in their navy blazers and gray slacks, these two gorilla-looking fools looming above me resemble ghetto prep schoolers held back 20 years. And here I am in my best gray suit from the Central Mission, quote, unhoused men's clothing exchange. Shirt and necktie, brown gaiters with tassels from Macy's and the Goodwill store, thank you. Now the red foam on my lips and stabbing pain in my gut tells me I'll see redder in my toilet if they ever let me out of this broom closet. A broom closet. They're in the basement of the ugliest building in Judiciary Square, like a Titan's tot with greasy fingers, stacked some gargantuan white Lego blocks. Pretty words cut above the lobby, though, in stone. Equal protection, due process of law.
So good. It's really good. So super authentic voice. So it's like present tense, first person. It's very immediate. Was that hard for you to write like that?
No, I mean, not as hard as with the first book, where it was present tense, second person. I mean, that's a nightmare. I Gary Phillips and Reed Farrell Coleman don't ask me if I, had my head exam, because I mean, first person is like, I did this, I did it. Second person is you did this, or you not, and second person present tense is you're getting up, you're walking to the bathroom, you look over your shoulder. I mean, try sitting up all night trying to type that, and not and keep your sanity. It's some people do it in short stories, but to do it in novel length, I thought I was gonna go crazy. And but I it's it gives the immediacy. But some of it, Jeff, I mean, some of it that I was when I was talking to Ilana Barry, I asked Barry about this, and she said, did you start off thinking you wanted to do that? And I said, no. Actually, George Pelicanos gave me the idea to do that, and that was because I wanted, when I set out to write a noir series, I told him, I said, I want to go write a noir series. And we were laughing because all the stuff that he used to write about was all gentrified. So the crack house that he wrote about in, Hard Revolution was now a coffee shop or an artisan olive oil place, or a place where you could go and make, clay figurines with your friends. It was, people weren't blowing each other's heads off in there anymore. What were we to do?
Only a writer would be upset
right.
about
I was like, God,
that, right?
what a, so, and so to make it interesting, and in addition to creating a character who started off homeless, was, to start it off in the second person present tense and then show his evolution as he gets more treatment and rehab, winding back the second person as he gets better, quote, better, unquote, into a more traditional first person narration, which is what you hear and see in all these kind of private detective trope. This is private detective trope, really. To now, he's it, it's first, it's still first person, but it's still unwinding. You're seeing it happen in real time, and I think that that's much more exciting for people.
I mean, that's a really interesting technique, and I don't think I've seen that before. Did you see that anywhere, or you just kind of you came up with that yourself?
I'll claim ownership of that. I'll claim ownership. And I like and I like to say that's a tribute to my own genius, because well, because usually, it's usually people who are a lot younger than me who come up with that, and when I talk to people who are younger, I mean, they didn't really, because even if you look at graphic novels that are written by younger people, it's still written, it's still kind of a third person point of view, and it's third person past tense almost, like Thor threw his hammer. It's not Thor throwing his hammer, so. I wanted to find a way to engage people.
Do you find it was it hard at all, like doing present tense? Because I know it's really in vogue now, right? Everyone seems to like they're doing it,
Yeah.
but for me, it's really difficult. It's just not the way I think about story.
It's very hard. And with everybody doing it now, it's it, you know, then you kind of like it's you're kind of like lost in the sauce. But I think it's hard doing it, like everything, Jeff, it's hard doing it right. If everybody's doing it, that's one thing. But if you got some people doing it right and some people not doing it right, then you do kind of stand out if you really take the time to do it right. And I try to do it right.
Yeah, I mean, you do a lot of interesting techniques here. Like even in that passage you just read, you break that fourth wall, right? You're like, oh, and now back to the beating, right? You're talking directly to the reader. How much do you feel like you follow rules or break? I mean, you're breaking. You obviously know literature, so you're breaking them intentionally, right? Like, what's your thought process when you're doing that?
Well, I mean, like I tell younger people, you have to know the rules before you can break them. A lot of people think, all right, I'm just going to jump right in and I'm just going to do whatever I want. And it's like, no, you have to understand the rules first. But I try to give people a, I try, I'm breaking the rules all the time, but I don't go crazy. I mean, you have a narration, a first person narration, and it does break up sometimes, and it's not always quote proper, but there is context there, and I trust my readers, I trust my fans enough to know that you have a guy here who started off as a scholar athlete at Howard University when he was 21. Now he's 50, basically. And he spent more time on the street and as a wino basically that he had in that previous life. But he still has pieces of his previous life in him. So sometimes when he speaks, he'll speak in what somebody might call proper English. But a lot of times he won't, because he has that breaking, I mean, if you have somebody who's been in prison for a long time, but didn't start off in prison, nobody's born in prison. I mean, they'll have that kind of a situation where their brain will switch back and forth. Or you'll have people who are, and it's not really code switching. So don't get, so that's not what I'm saying. It's a totally two different thing. But it's basically you've had a bunch of different experiences in your life. And going back to what to I asked Barry, Alana Barry, if you're in the CIA and you're used to lying to people all the time, and when you're telling the truth, sometimes that, one brain bleeding into another is going to be hard to, that takes its toll. So it's hard to say where one voice leaves off and another picks up. So sometimes there's a lapse. So I want people to see, sometimes when it looks like I'm breaking a rule, I'm not really breaking a rule. I'm just being true to the character. So sometimes the character does have, speaking of ellipses, he will have ellipses in thought, but that's just him trying, his brain basically rebooting, because he was drinking. He was, smoking the Kush, as he said. He was, high all the time. He did have a breakdown with fentanyl at one point. So it's really just trying to be true to the character and keep things in context. However, I do break rules where I think I can get sneaky and break them.
And it's such a unique character. Did you have this kind of whole arc in mind at the beginning? Because you're over multiple books, and how are you dealing with that? Because you have to have change in each book, but it's a series, right? So, were you looking over the horizon the whole time, like you knew where you were going with
Yeah,
this?
I was trying to, and that's the beauty of initially, of course, being with an independent publisher, that they give you the freedom to do that. When I published the first two hardcovers with Random House years ago, I mean, it was very regimented. And when we did the Tales of Wakanda and the Sam Wilson book, I mean, Marvel is like, it's like if you deviate from this, they call it a Bible for a reason. They do. I mean, when you do short story collections, they have a Bible, but it's not that crazy. But if you work for Marvel, it really is like a fundamentalist Bible. You get stoned if you deviate. But with an independent publisher, they give you a little bit more leeway. So I was able to really suss out how I really wanted to approach this, and they gave me a lot of freedom in that. And as to how I did it. Yeah, so I planned it out.
I'm really interested in the whole graphic novel thing. Was that something that you enjoyed reading before, or how did you get into it? And how do you break into like the Marvel universe? That seems like it's a tough sell, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, luckily, knowing there is a lot of overlap between hard-boiled writers, like people like Gary Phillips, Alex Segura, people like that, and that world. So it's not that tough to talk to them, and you get kind of sucked into that. And they also know some of the writers, like the artists like Sean Martin Bro and people like that. So I'm not like part of that club, but it's nice to be able to be called upon to help out. I help out with story ideas and stuff like that. So it's different. I mean, for them, it's more like writing a movie script or a television script. It's not really like writing prose at all. So it's a different muscle you're working there. But I like it because you have, it's more collaborative. Writing novels, as you know, is a lonely, even short stories, is a lonely just trudge. It's a baton death march in front of a screen. So, but with the graphic novel things, it's more of a collaboration. You're talking to people, other writers, and then you're dealing with an artist too, and the artist has a lot of input. So it's definitely a different kind of thing. It's interesting.
Was that tough though? I mean, I get, you have the social element to it. You're bouncing ideas off each other in a lot of ways. The sum of the whole is greater than the individual parts. But also, you're so used to just being, the king of the story
Yeah,
there.
that's it, it's kind of an ego smash because you're dealing with people who have been doing it, whether they've been novelists at first or they've always been doing this, and they basically tell you to shut up. And then, it's like, well, I think we should no. You just give us the idea here. Luckily, I've been able to stay in my lane and give, be more of a story idea person, right? But every now and then I would give script kind of ideas, balloon ideas, but a lot of it, to tell you the truth, I started out, it was really kind of just keeping the story on track and talking to them about that. But every now and then they'll let me, think of, talk to the artist about how something should be laid out. And I got to tell you, it's tough. It is tough. It is hard work. But I will say this, the greatest work of noir hard-boiled fiction I have ever seen is a graphic novel called Black Sad. It's a two-volume set. Guy's only done two of them. The problem is the characters are all animals. So when it came out, people thought it was a cozy. But you have to picture the sleuth is a big giant black cat named John Black Sad, and he's got a trench coat and every animal stereotype you can think of. The police captain of NYPD is what? A German Shepherd. Okay? And it takes place in the 50s. So it has that noir character to it. It even has kind of a 1950s kind of racism thing because he has to go down to New Orleans and find some guy, a guy, he's not a guy, he's an otter, and bring him back. And there are these racist animals, and some of them are polar bears and Arctic foxes. They're all like white animals, okay? And an albino rhinoceros. It's crazy. But it is pure noir, hard-boiled stuff. And it is amazing stuff. But they are all animals. And when it came out, people didn't take it seriously because they thought, animals, cozy. But the stories are adult stories, and it's it blew my mind.
I'm picturing how many parents bought that for their kids, thinking it was a.
And there's violence. Like I said, it takes place in the 50s. It takes place in New York. There's violence, sex, everything. And like I said, the cops are all German Shepherds and Malinois, and he's this big black cat named John Black Sad, and it is a weird thing. But when you look at it and you translate it to humans, it's an amazing work. But a lot of people bought that for their kids. And they would go to the store and buy this, even though, the covers of the first one were pretty bleak. And they'd just buy it and the kids would be like, oh wow, this is great. Like, no.
So your love of this genre, your love of writing, just kind of comes through when you're talking, it comes through in your writing. Is this something that you always knew you wanted to do?
Yes and yes. Yes and yes, and then yes and no. I have, when I grew up, growing up, my mother and father were very, they wanted to make sure I did what I wanted to do, but within very strict guardrails. So in other words, whatever wasn't practical, I couldn't do. So this is not eminently not practical. But I always had a voice and a little person inside me that I wanted to feed that was more creative. And so if I could give that little voice little chunks of myself every now and then, because I've always had a day job, and I always wanted to define myself as somebody who's always had a day job but could also do this. Sometimes when I, and I think that despite that, And my output has not been what, you know, what I could have been if I had just charged into this full time. But I've never had the resources or the willingness to actually do that, because I've always defined myself as somebody who can do both. And I'm proud that I can do both. But sometimes I do get discouraged that I wish I had more time or I wish I had more output. But I've managed to make a good name for myself. I mean, and I've got, and people, peers have recognized me, and it's very humbling. You know, it's like I got on the BoucherCon board, and I'm now, you know, I'm president of MWA's Mid-Atlantic chapter now. So, you know, it is, you know, that says something to me, and it's very humbling. But there are times when I wish, you know, I wish I had more time. I could have knuckled under and done more of this and that. But it, you know, it's like anything with the arts, you know, artists and craftsmen, no matter what you call yourself, you're always going to question you could have done more.
You know, I've spoken to authors who went full time into writing too, and then actually produced less because, right, your time is so finite when you're working, and you have these strict, you know, kind of guardrails around your work, and so it forced them to do more as opposed to having the whole day when you're available. What would you say are some of like the key elements of your being able to motivate yourself to work full time, have a successful professional career, and write? Like, what would you tell another writer who's trying to do this?
I would tell them to, first of all, I would tell them, don't do what I do. Do whatever makes you comfortable. Some people do the get up at 3 o'clock in the morning thing. I can't do that. I can do that if there are deadlines and there's rewriting done, to be done. But the creative process, it hits you when it hits you. You know, it hits you in the shower, but it can hit you at any time. But when it hits you, you have to surrender to it. You know, if you're in the middle of something that's important, day job wise, but something hits you, you probably you. What I do is I try to pull myself out, write something down, and then go back and refocus, because I'm not going to sit there and push it down. Because if I push it down, it's gone. It's gone. It's you know, it is like a fairy or a ghost. It's gone. But what I do say is, you know, don't try to force anything into a corral. Do what makes you comfortable, and make the people around you understand that this is not a hobby. Even if you're not doing it full time, it is not a hobby. It's a calling. And if it's a calling, you know, hopefully people will respect you for that. Because they're not going to respect you if you call it a hobby. If you say, I try to do it, you know, I'm trying to scribble a little bit here and type a little bit there, they're going to pat you on the back and say, that's nice. But if you really, you know, stand up for yourself and say, no, this is something I really want to do, people will have a lot more respect for you. Even if you don't publish a single word, you know, officially, they will have a lot more respect for you if you say, look, I want to do this. This is what I really want to do. And that's with a lot of things. Whether you want to sculpt, do watercolors, climb mountains, you know, if you're upfront with people about what you want to do, they'll have a lot more respect for you than if you say, oh, I'm kind of dabbling. Yeah, I don't think this is is this good? Yeah, you know, I had some bouncing some ideas in my head. No, I mean, get up front, you know, stand up for yourself.
Did you find it harder before, like, you won awards, before you've received the acclaim that you now have, when you were looking at this as, like, you know, a calling's internal, right?
Right.
But when you're externally telling people this is something, when you're not making the money, when you're not a national bestseller, like, do you find it was harder for people to respect the time or your effort you're putting into it?
Well, yeah, that's like anything. I mean, come on. If you're a journeyman and you're really making it work, but people aren't seeing the outward fruits of it. There's, you know, but all of a sudden, if they see something in Publishers Weekly, or there's something in the Post, or there's something in that, then all of a sudden, oh wow, Chris, hey, you know, it's like I told you know. But you know what, Jeff? I mean, the thing is, the people who love you and who believe in you are always going to love you and believe in you, and the people who even if they don't know you and like your stuff, they're gonna like your stuff. So that's what sustains people, I think.
That's great. You mentioned BoucherCon and Mystery Writers of America. Do you want to talk about MWA a little bit and what you're doing and what the organization is doing for writers?
Yeah, MWA was founded 80 years ago by a bunch of I mean, by Ellery Queen, who was a real person, not a fictional person. That was a nom de plume and a bunch of other people, around the time, of contemporaries of Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, people like that, Earl Stanley Gardner, who wrote the Perry Mason. But Perry Mason originally was a hard-boiled noir series, not Raymond Burr on TV. But it's basically like the kind of overarching union, if you will. I mean, I don't know of any other analogy that would work for crime fiction writers and nonfiction as well. And it's divided into chapters, and they give out the Edgars every year, which is kind of like our Oscars. And it's a very big prestigious kind of an event. And it's something that people in our craft really aspire to. There's always people who don't like it because there are a lot of people who don't like the Oscars. But it's amazing, with the Oscars and the Grammys and the Emmys, there's always people who always hate them, but they always want to watch, right? I hate the Grammys. Beyoncé hasn't won one, but you always watch, right? So that's what it is, So it's like that. BoucherCon is the actual convention of our, of our art form, if you will, and each city's bid on it each year. This year it's going to be in New Orleans. Last year it was in Nashville. In 2027, it will be here at the Marriott Woodman Park, and the guests of honor will be George Pelecanos and Laura Lippman, who is a kind of like the Bard of Baltimore. Which is interesting. She used to be married to David Simon, who gave us what, if you're from here, The Wire. Yes. And she's a very famous novelist, and hopefully he'll be there for that. We'll see how the ex-husband, ex-wife thing plays out there. But they're the guests of honor in 2027. In 2026, it'll be in Calgary. Hopefully, there won't be a war with Canada by then. We won't be POWs and not be allowed to come back. But that would be, yeah, that'd be interesting. It's there. Our genre is, I like to say, our genre is like jazz. It's like our gift to the world. I mean, yes, Agatha Christie was British, and you have Sherlock Holmes and all those people, from way back when to now, Irvine Welsh, the new school kinds of guys who wrote Trainspotting and stuff like that. But we in America, I think, have taken this crime genre and has taken it to another level, and we basically invented it here. The guy who, we named the award after, Edgar Allan Poe, was the first one, and a lot of other people, various types of people, and people that are being rediscovered, not discovered, but rediscovered now. Various writers of color and women who've been around almost as long as he has, who've taken that art form, and because stories about people getting murdered, I mean, that's as old as time. Anybody can write about a cat solving a murder. All right, that's a cozy. But when a human does it, there's something visceral there. And to do it right and not make it a crazy and not make it gratuitous and weave a good story around it, that's a real art form. And I think people appreciate that. And I think that's what Americans have given the world, is that, even though, again, you have Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie, you have new kinds of genres in other countries. You have the Scandinavians, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, that whole series. The guy, and now I'm having an old man moment, who wrote the Snowman, they did with
Oh, man.
What's that?
Terrible.
I think the movie was with Michael Fassbender, and he was at BosherCon in Minnesota, the guy who actually wrote those books. But see, but those books are based on what Americans have done in noir. In a way, they were basically emulating what we were doing. So even something like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and all those types of books are based on what we were doing. And then you have people like Chester Hines, who's always been unsung. I mean, one of the great crime writers of all times, a contemporary of Raymond Chandler, a contemporary of Dashiell Hammett, a contemporary of F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was, I'm sorry, and we had the event here, a crime writer. And I actually worked on an article in Crime Reads with Maureen Corrigan, and The Great Gatsby itself was not the great American novel. It was a crime story that became the great American novel, because what was Jay Gatsby? He was a money launderer for gangsters. If I wrote The Great Gatsby now, Jay Gatsby would be working for the Mexican cartel. Would he still be Leonardo DiCaprio? I don't know. But that's the stylizing of literature. But this is our gift to the world, is this kind of point of view about crime fiction. We owe our audiences good stories.
Well, it's a great organization. I'm happy to be a member of it. So I'm going to go to audience questions, but first I have to ask you just a couple of process questions. So
Sure.
30 seconds here. Let's keep them short. You outliner or pantser?
Pantser.
When do you write?
Anytime I can.
So by the way, have you ever heard of Aqua Notes that go up in the shower with a little pencil on
Yes,
them? I
I was
actually
trying.
have those.
I was thinking about that. I actually was thinking about that, but then I didn't want my wife to get upset seeing crazy stuff while she was taking a shower. Like, he took the knife and stuck it in his eye while she's trying to put on her conditioner. So I was like,
It's like a shining moment,
yes,
right? All
right.
right.
Oh yeah, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. I didn't want her to see that.
And what do you write in? What software?
Just Word, and I use LegalPads for ideas, but I don't write out stories. I type them, but I write out ideas longhand.
Do you use editing software?
No, just my fingers and my head.
Do you listen to music?
No. I can't do that. I can do that when I'm doing line edits, but no, I have to be focused.
So can you write anywhere, or do you mostly do it in a home office?
In a home office, and in a home office mostly, because when I'm working, I don't try to mix that together. If something hits me, if I'm working, I'll do it at work. If I'm editing a little, I'll do it at work. But it's not, it's one or the other. And my boss is sitting over there, so of course I can't say I go brick.
Do you write a first draft straight through, or do you stop and edit as you go?
Stop and edit. I shouldn't do that. And one of the things that Walter Mosley said, which comes from straight from that movie Finding Forrester, is that you just write it and then go in and tear it up. But I can't do that. You got you know I got to go in and monkey around with it.
Do you use beta readers before it goes to your publisher?
No, just me.
Nobody sees it before your publisher.
Just me.
Very cool. Okay, I'm going to come around for questions. If you have them, just raise your hand and just speak right into the microphone so we can pick it up on the podcast. Any questions over here? Yes.
So, Chris, you mentioned Doyle and Christie. They both famously created their best creation, Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot. How do you feel about Sticky Corch?
Oh, I don't hate him at all. I mean, I hate that he went through the stuff he goes through, and I hate that he's not John Shaft or something like that. He's not supposed to be, but I love him because he's indestructible. I mean, you give me the person who's the last man standing over the one who's the smartest or the most clever or this, because that person takes a punch and comes back. The smarter people, something's always going bad's going to happen to them. But I like him because he's always the last person standing.
And one more, how much of you did you put into your character?
With him, not a lot. some of it in the initial story, I will say this, there were some kind of dad issues in the initial story. But you know, as my cousins over there can see, whenever you have a West Indian father, you're always going to have dad issues. So I put a little of that in there, but nothing crazy, but not a lot.
Questions on this side?
Where can we get Leviathan?
That is in a collection that you can still get on an Amazon. I'm trying to remember what it is, but I can send it to you. And that actually was an interesting story. They were trying to sell it to Netflix, to the series, not Black Mirror, but Love something Robots.
Love.
Yeah. Yeah. But we didn't quite get it to it. So.
Okay. The Marvel characters that you've had to deal with, you know, Sam Wilson, T'Challa, they're the opposite end of the spectrum from any of the characters that I know that you created yourself. Okay. How different is your process when you're forced to write about one of these heroes?
Well, I tell you, I avoided that by writing about the sister, Shuri. That was a good way to duck that out but keep him in the story, because she's kind of an interesting character in the comic book canon. You know, now I'm not talking about the movies. With the story in the next one, I mean, I try to keep, you know, if you look at the movie that's out now, it's very, very complex characters. There's a lot of stuff, subtext there, and I try to, like, really zero in on that. I mean, you know, the movie's been out for a while, so I don't think I'm spoiling anything for people, but, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on now with Carl Lumbly, who was, a lot of people didn't know, was the original guy that was given the super soldier serum. Very, very Tuskegee-like. You know, so instead of giving it to Steve Rogers, let's give it to the black guy and see if his head explodes. And it didn't, so we'll give it to Steve Rogers and have him go fight the Nazis. So the black guy's head didn't explode, but we can't have him in a red, white, and blue costume and go fight the Nazis. So we'll lock him up for 40 years, and then Sam Wilson kind of discovers, you know, and so how does he, you know, noodle that through in his new role? I mean, that's not my story, obviously, but I mean, what I'm thinking of is how, you know, the humanity part of it. Because, you know, again, noir is stylized realism. What's the realistic part? What's the human part there? With the Black Panther thing, it's basically her, you know, Shuri. What she's dealing with some interesting things too, and then she comes up against a person who is totally wacko and off the scale in Namor, and an interesting side story there. I had to work on that story before I knew about the movie, and they kept all that secret from me until I had to rewrite it to fit into to avoid the movie thing. And so I didn't know that Namor was going to be, you know, a Mayan and everything. I wrote my story of Namor was the original Namor, who was a bigger asshole than any Mayan, blue Mayan. I mean, you know, if any of you are, you know, familiar with this character, the guy's a lunatic. I guess I would be too if I had, you know, wings on my feet, you know, and I looked like Mr. Spock, you know, and I was wet all the time. But I mean, you know, I actually had a line in there where this old lady who Shuri had befriended from Baltimore called him, you know, you Mr. Spock looking MF or something like that. But I mean, I try to make it somewhat realistic. And I think they found that charming, but I had to keep in a groove. If I deviated, then you got the riot act read to you.
I've known you all this time, and I've never actually had the chance to ask this question. In Scavengers, the subculture of the Scavengers was so bizarre, almost like you created it like a science fiction world.
It is.
Is any of it real, or is that a creation out of your mind? And if it is, how'd you come up with it?
It was real. It's not real anymore. Like, for example, these guys, they don't do the jump, they call them clean out crews. They don't do that anymore. They don't hire men off the street anymore. But at one time, if you were a residential landlord and you were evicting people, they would hire these guys off the street and pay them like, you know, Metro, give them a Metro card and $5 or maybe a Happy Meal and have them take the stuff out. And they would, and a lot of times they would steal because they would just put it out on the curb. But a lot of times they steal that stuff and do with it what they would do. I mean, and then sometimes they take it back to their little encampments, you know, and make stuff out of it. I mean, if you had a perfectly nice flat screen TV, you know, why not? You know, try to put it under your arm and get on the Metro with it, even if you could jump the turnstile with it. So that they don't really do that anymore. But it was interesting to just try to talk to people about that kind of stuff and just get to try to get inside their heads about that. Because my character, he didn't want to panhandle. He was too, quote, too proud to do that. This is how he made his bucks when he wasn't living in the shelter.
I'm 100%. I read the first book, Scavenger, right? And so Dickie Cornish was this crazed person escaping from the... I want to know about the title and also what stage is he now? Is he at? Is he like, you know, what kind of character is he now?
Well, it's when you go from Scavenger to Standalone, which is, you know, he was standing alone against two rival factions in the police department, which was interesting to write too. I mean, you talk about you know, Sam was like, "Do any of you and the character?" I mean, try explaining that to DC cops, because they're. There's some of them saying, "Yeah, I know that the commander of the seventh is just like in that," and then the other would say, "No, it's like that," you know. So it that was tough right there. That was scary. But he's in this book. The titles all mean something. And usually titles. Sometimes people come up with a title first. I don't do that. My editor, Peter Karloftis, he's the title whisperer. He usually, you know, sprinkles a fairy dust. And he said, you know, this plot, even though I'm more of a character-driven person, this plot really begs that title. Like, what is, you know, streetwise? Like, there's a lot of different layers of stuff right on the grit of the street up to the political stuff that's kind of on high. That he's dragged into, and that, you know, they converge. That was important for this book because this was the only book where that kind of a convergence of what's going on the street does touch on the national politics in a way. The first two really didn't have anything to do with that, even though the second one took place during COVID. And I try to be realistic about that. And I'm not abashed about what, you know, where it's supposed to be realistic. The first one takes place during the first Trump administration. The second one takes place during COVID and Biden is president. The third one's taking place, it's set maybe August, September, October of 2024. And then there's a very specific reason for that leading up to the election. So, you know, this is about realism. But the title was something that my publisher said it's important to tie all that in, just like the first two. Obviously, for the first one, it was easy because it is Scavenger. But that's why he was taken off the street by an unsavory person and cleaned up and turned into kind of an amateur sleuth to serve this person's kind of nefarious needs. So, you know, because he did have those skills. But as you can see, the skills that he had on the street, you still see them here, but they kind of morph into something different. He's not really, in this book, he's not using what he used when he was on the street. He's a different person. So it's still there, but he's developed into something else. And I think, you know, it's almost like, ideally, like if you spent 20 years in prison and you're out now and you're working in a job, you kind of don't want those skills that you had when you were in prison, you know, working your way into your job now. You know, you're not going to shank somebody in the lunchroom because they took your bag of egg salad. Okay. I mean, you know, you're going to say, oh, I put my name on this brown paper bag who took my egg salad. You're not going to shank that person. Right. So, I mean, I wouldn't, but I mean, so you see some of the skills that he had, he leaves by the wayside.
So great questions. I have one final question for you, and I've asked all our authors this, and I get some really interesting answers. Where do you think story comes from? When these fictional stories come into your head, how does that happen?
Well, what you don't want to do is like copy from people. You don't want to plagiarize in any way, shape, or form. But you can get inspiration, you know, from people. There's nothing wrong with that. Inspiration, I mean, and there's a fine line between inspiration and copying off of people, as everybody knows. But you can get inspiration from just a feeling about somebody has done something or touched on some angle in one book, and you say, wow, I'd like to really take that and blow it up. And then there's just stuff that's just out there. You know, and you know, I mean, there aren't that many eureka moments, Jeff. I mean, you know, some people have them, some people don't. I think a lot of times there are basic human stories, but the people who are true artists, like Sean Cosby, for example, All the Sinners Bleed, the basic premise of that book is nothing that kind of, you know, sprung from, you know, Zeus's thigh like Athena. I mean, you know, but what he did with it was just take it and turn it into like an amazing, just visceral story. That's where the art is. So, you know, yeah, there are some interesting, you know, every now and then people have these truly original eureka moments. I mean, I think for me, Scavenger was kind of lightning in a bottle. And it was meant to do that, to kind of pull people in. But then, yes, I was eventually going to come back to something more traditional. But the key is to try to do the traditional stuff well after I kind of hooked them with that. Because I don't think I'm going to be able to repeat something like that. That's a hard thing to do. You can't, you know, you can't do that. You know, it's like I'm the firstborn kid. I'm the original. I'm the best. Okay, you know, my brother and sister, you know, I'm the lightning in the bottle. What are you going to, you know? So,
where should your readers go to find you? Do you want them to go to Amazon, or do you want them to go to your website, or where should they?
They could go anywhere. They could Amazon, Barnes and Noble, any store. They can get them today, personalized. Any store, you know, where you buy your books, and it's on ebook and it's on audio. Also, the actor who did Scavenger and Standalone, very, very good. And he is fantastic. There's no way I would read this myself. I don't know why people do that. You know, this guy is great. He is great. So anywhere you buy books, you can get it. You can get it today here.
So he's got him for sale up here. I'd ask everybody two things. One, if you could go on Amazon and just rate his book, it really helps with discoverability for authors. It takes like 15 seconds. And also, if you like our literary salon here, if you could go on to Open Table or Google or Yelp or wherever you rate, just give us a rating. We'd really appreciate that as well. Chris, has been a real honor. I love your writing. Thank Congratulations you. On all your success.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.